jazz.
Busted.
That's you better enjoy my rants, because I got nothing to say about this stuff today. I've been so swamped with work and I'm miserable. I have a horrible headache. And enjoy my ranting now, because I'm just going to be nodding a lot and saying, yes, Patrick. Yes, Patrick.
All right. You know, I was thinking, and since you're going to Mike is going to bring a guest on, we hope, a special guest.
Yes.
And if he's able to do this, we're going to ask him to run the podcast. So I thought maybe today on our fifth anniversary show, I'd let you introduce. Do you want to introduce the podcast this time? It's only been 5 years. I mean, do you want to take a shot?
Have I never introduced it? What are you talking about?
You've never actually just opened the podcast. It's always been me. And then I say, either I'm me or you're you. And then we go back and forth. But I don't know. I mean, do you want to use the same catchphrase, you know, welcome to Jazz Bastard? Or how would you do it?
This is a weighty responsibility. I've never thought hard about this before. God, I'm a little bowled over. I don't know what to say. I guess I could. I don't know. It'd be like it'd be in a bizarro universe. I would suddenly feel like I have to have smart things to say. And yeah, no, we should just do it the old way. You just do your thing and I'll just nod sagely like I know what I'm talking about.
Okay, I was going to ask the listeners to clap to give you strength. And then I realized they'd be clapping after the show was already taped. So it probably wouldn't work.
It's kind of like a whole time warp thing you're opening up now. It's kind of disturbing.
Yeah, it's a little anyway. Well, we tried, listeners. We tried it. But it'll happen someday. It'll happen. He'll be ready, but it's a pretty heavy responsibility. So it's up to me, Pat, to say, welcome to Jazz Bastard Podcast 130. Say it with wood. It's our fifth anniversary special.
Normally I'm responsible for the dick jokes, but okay. Yeah. Wow.
What is that guy? You know, that's, it can't be the fifth. Is that your fifth anniversary gift? I think
you still have wood at your fifth anniversary, that's a good sign.
Okay. There you go. Okay, let's keep going. I thought it had to do with actual like wooden knickknacks or something, but I guess one man's knickknack is another man's cross to bear. So he's Mike as usual, and
he's still Pat.
Yeah, I'm still Pat. God knows. And we've picked up a tradition, and I didn't check whether this goes all the way back to the second, but certainly by the third anniversary, Mike suggested we do ensembles whose membership match the number of our anniversary. So last year it was quartets, year before it was trios, and of course this year it's quintets.
How much longer can we keep this going, by the way?
Well, I think the problem is going to be those awkward gaps. Non-answer, not unknown.
Septets.
Yeah,
septets, octets. No, there's some octets.
Yeah.
There's some septets.
We've got octets, we've got non-ets. Tentets, a little bit less. Mulligan had one. And then, yeah, as you kind of get up there, but not quite to big band size, you really have to start kind of scampering about trying to find out, you know, there were probably some, for whatever reason, smaller ensembles. You know, we can, when we're doing our 40th, we can just do Kenton. But yeah, there's kind of a less traditional. And I do feel like, in a sense, we are now on the borderline. I don't know about you, but when I listen to a album that has six members, I kind of start expecting there to be a little bit more emphasis on arranging. I sort of ask myself, well, if you got three horns in the front line or a couple horns and vibes or whatever, I'm expecting maybe a little more effort in the writing then. Whereas I feel like a quintet, like a quartet, it's not that the heads can't be interesting, but that's kind of standard issue combo. And when I get that six member, I'm like asking, well, any particular reason we're adding? You know, I mean, what's the goal here? Is it to get thicker harmonies or more interesting arrangements? Or is it because by that, it just seems like you're signaling a kind of ambition, I guess, if you go up there with a quintet. It may just be the trumpeter wants to rest his or her chops. It's just kind of a standard thing, certainly from the Blue Note era forward.
I guess the only exception I would say would be sextets, where the three frontline guys are actually really quite good. And it's almost always in a bebop setting or something like that, right? So Miles and Coltrane and Adderley, right?
Right.
So you'd get that sometimes, right? But even then, it's already verging into all-star territory, isn't it? Like, everyone's like, ah, oh, wow. That's not a usual formation. You don't see that a lot. You're right.
Yeah.
But I could see it in a bebop setting where it's just like, okay, all three guys are going to we're going to play the head, and then everyone's going to take some choruses.
Yeah.
It makes a certain amount of sense there.
Yeah, I mean, some of the West Coast sessions Parker did, right, had an extra horn, and it was just largely, we're going to play the head together, and then there's going to be one more solo kind of thing.
Right.
Generally, after the 50s, I'm kind of asking myself. But anyway, with quintets, it is very, very standard. There are thousands and thousands of jazz recordings in this format. And I guess to some degree, we kind of picked ones with a bit of a twist. Oliver Lake's Prophet from 1980 was one of my choices, and I did manage to pick two albums released on Black Saint led by alto saxophone players from the 80s, so it was kind of a narrow range there, but those are just ones that kind of popped to mind. There, I guess, really, it's a pretty standard ensemble, trumpet, alto, piano, bass, drums. It's just that we're looking at someone coming from more of the left field tradition. I mean, Oliver Lake, even in his most conservative moments, you never mistake one of his sessions for something from Blue Note.
Right.
And this is actually one of two tributes he made to Eric Dolphy. He also does another one.
I was going to ask. I did not do any reading for this, but I was like, okay, that makes a shit ton of sense. Okay.
Right, because he had two Dolphy numbers on there.
And a lot of Dolphy-esque playing.
Right, yeah, absolutely. He does one in the 90s that is even, it's a little bit more mainstream than this even. Just does a lot of Dolphy repertoire, and it's just extremely pleasant. Lake's always challenging, but it's accessible.
Is that a word you'd use with him? Pleasant? But okay, exactly. We'll come back to that later.
Right. I mean, by his standards, it's about as easygoing as Lake ever gets. Certainly, he is not, as I said, when I saw him live, it was hardcore free improvisation. There was no Dolphy covers of that show. So it's not like he softened in his old age. The show I saw here in Lund was very much waving the free jazz banner. There was moments of melodicism and great interaction. It wasn't like just noise or energy, but it was out. My other selection's a little bit odder. It's led by Jimmy Lyons, an alto player we associate a lot with Cecil Taylor. And he's got a quintet, but along with a trumpet player, he's got a bassoon player.
Yes.
Karen Porca, as well as bass and drums.
If there's anything I like only slightly less than tuba, it's bassoon. You can't have enough tuba jazz, and really there's not enough bassoon jazz in the world.
It's a
great choice.
We can talk about that later. And so what were your two choices here?
So my choices were made because we have a huge amount of overlap in our collections, and I'm despaired of finding anything on my shelves that you didn't have already. So I'm going to give a shout out here. I went up to the best used record store in San Diego for CDs anyway. Not as good as it used to be, but south of LA, it's probably the best. In LA, of course, Amoeba Records is the place to go. But here in San Diego, the best place is this record shop called Lose Records, which used to have a booming business in new releases. And I was sort of hoping to go up there and get new releases, but I hadn't been there in a while. And they've shut down the new releases annex. It's gone. So it's just, you know, it used to be two buildings, so now there's just one building. It's just all used CDs, or some stuff's like recently released, but you know, it's nothing like in the old place. You know, you could go in and, you know, they'd have 27 Brad Meldow CDs, and they're all new. You could sort of, it was a little bit like Tower used to be, not nearly as big, but if you were looking for something, there's a good chance he had it. And there is a Lou at Lou's Records up in Encinitas. Anyway, now, of course, they've gone the way of vinyl, so they have a huge vinyl collection. When you come out again, you'll have to go up there. They have tons of vinyl. But yeah, so I went went and hit the jazz section to see if I could find a couple of things that I had not heard before. And I actually came up with four or five, but in the end, I boiled my choices down to two. One was Kenny Cox, his contemporary jazz quintet. And this is actually, a Blue Note re-release. They combine his initial release, introducing Kenny Cox and the contemporary jazz quintet, with Multi-Direction. So it's really two for the price of one. And what I liked about it was it's sort of just a classic Blue Note lineup. And I bought it without even hearing it. I just thought, this is interesting. We've got five dudes on Blue Note, 1968. This is sort of going to be bebop heaven. And as we'll get to it, it turns out it's not quite that at all. And surprisingly better than I would have guessed. I'm like, I've never heard of Kenny Cox. The only player on this album that I had heard of does not have what you would call, you know, a superstar career. So I was like, all right, so this will be interesting. We'll look at a quintet that's sort of in the Blue Note mold. I was hoping for average, and I don't think it's average, but we'll talk about that. And then the other selection was actually a nod back to our very first show, because I'm all sentimental like that. I found Ronald Shannon Jackson's Decoding Society, his disc called Shannon's House. Because if you recall our very first podcast, we did a Ronald Shannon Jackson CD called Nasty. And I believe you entitled the podcast Mike Doesn't Like It Nasty. So it was a sort of throwback to the beginning of the podcast, I thought. And since we hadn't done anything else by him. So I picked this and knowing absolutely nothing about it except that I don't like it nasty. This is like your selection has some quirky personnel. So it's got a guitarist. I take it Rochella is a woman. I won't have pictures of who's on this album, so could be a man, but Rochella Parks okay. on sax, a keyboard player, a bass player, and Shannon Jackson on drums, and wait for it, Chalmay. He's playing Chalmay.
Mein Instrument ist die Chalmay. Das ist eins der ältesten Instrumente, vor über 2000 Jahren im Orient erfunden.
We get a list we get credits on the inside of the material with the CD that tells us he plays sonar drums, but it doesn't tell us what kind of chalmay he plays. So I'm really curious who provided the chalmay on this album, and also if anyone could just show me what a chalmay looks
like. You're wearing one right now and you don't even know it.
I guess I could look it up on the internet, but it's more fun to imagine what a chalmay is and what Shannon Jackson is doing to it. I'm wearing a chalmay. Yeah. In fact, I'm playing it right now. So I thought that was like a weird, slightly odd quintet, bass, guitar, tenor, piano, and drums. So, cool. You know, it's a guitar, so it's frontline voice instead of perhaps the usual trumpet. So a throwback to our first podcast. So that was I was being all sentimental.
The circle is unbroken. Well, as usual, I guess let's do it chronologically, unless you got another plan.
Sounds good to me.
Which would bring up Kenny and the gentleman playing that contemporary jazz back in 68 and 69, I think it was. So you actually had some lowdown on Kenny Cox, didn't you?
I did some research, like even like more than browsing the internet, right? So after I got it, I of course open up the booklet, and there's all sorts of fascinating, interesting information here. And very early in the dealio, it mentions that Kenny is from Detroit and he had played with Charles McPherson.
Oh, okay.
Charles McPherson is someone who I know, who lives here locally and who I've had some dealings with. So I called Charles up, both to lay the groundwork for doing a podcast with him, hopefully in the very near future. So listeners who like Charles Mingus, beware. Charles McPherson knows all the stories. He played with Mingus for quite a while. Anyway, Charles is still a very active presence and an interesting guy in his own right. So anyway, and if you look online, you'll see that, you know, it says Kenny Cox played with Charles McPherson. So I thought I'd give Charles a ring. And he gave me a lot of just sort of interesting, I don't know, general background, which I thought was kind of fascinating. More than sort of more personal stuff than what's in the booklet, which is just Kenny Cox and this jazz quintet. These are all Detroit players and they're all young. They're pretty young guys. And so I just asked Charles, what album did he play on with you? And Charles, like, none. So somehow the internet has got Kenny playing on an album with Charles. Probably more likely, Charles said, it's just that they're Detroit guys. Charles is born in Missouri, but he came up in Detroit. And Charles's memory is that, you know, he was several years older than Kenny Cox. Kenny Cox was like from the next generation behind him. And then when we got to talking and looking at dates, it was kind of surprising. He said Kenny Cox is actually a year younger than him, not 3 or 4 years. He knew him. He knew him in high school, he said. And they, of course, played with a lot of the same players. But McPherson was a little bit more of an early developer and had sort of played with and met giants in the music. Even as a teenager, he had met Parker as a teenager. So McPherson, although is only a year older than Kenny Cox, was a little bit further along, or significantly further along, perhaps, in his career. And McPherson had already up stumps for New York City, which this will just substantiate the stories that people hear. You know, if you were going to be someone in jazz, you had to go to New York City. You just had to. That was the only place where you were going to make a name for yourself. And when he went to New York City, he hooked up with a lot of Detroit players, Roy Brooks, Louis Hayes, Lonnie Hillier, his friend. And there was an older generation of Detroit players there who we got to know, Doug Watkins, Paul Chambers. And Kenny was just like a little bit behind. He was just like a year back. And he never moved to New York City. He always was Detroit based. He got a gig working for Etta Jones, and he toured with her for a few years, and he met a lot of people, but he came back to kind of settle in Detroit. And Charles was saying, basically, in jazz at that time, you have kind of type A personalities, people who want to kind of make it, you know, and see if they can make it, and some can't, and some can. And then he said there's a lot of players who just weren't like that, who were sort of quiet, they were soft-spoken, and he mentioned Wes Montgomery kind of prominently, who everyone knew
right.
was a great player and could have made it in New York at any time he wanted to. But Charles said the guy had a kid every other year, and he was raising a family, and he had a regular gig in Indianapolis that paid well, and he just was not going to uproot his family. And Wes really only came to prominence. He'd been around for a while. He only came to prominence when other players like dragged him with guaranteed money and guaranteed gigs to New York City, where everyone was like, oh yeah, he really is like God. But for a long time, he just was settled, just didn't want to uproot his family. And Charles's memory of Kenny is that he is very much in that Detroit style. His hero was Tommy Flanagan, another Detroit pianist. And Charles said he even kind of looked like Tommy Flanagan. They sort of looked the same. And he said he was this very quiet, soft-spoken dude. And, you know, the other guys who he reminded Charles of were also Detroit players. Barry Harris, Hank Jones, an even older generation. All the Jones boys came from Detroit. So he kind of reminded him of players like that. And he noticed, and when I talked to him about the disc, and we're going to talk about this in a second, when you have a quintet on Blue Note in the 60s, you naturally think, well, we're going bebop, right? Because there are so many of them, right? There are just so many of these Hank Mobley kind of quintet.
Right, kind of hard bop.
Yeah.
Bluesy, yeah.
And that's what I expected when I opened this disc, and we'll talk about what's on in a minute, but it wasn't that. It has some hard bop stuff, but it's, I would argue, profoundly influenced by Miles Davis' second quintet. For that reason alone, it's a fascinating document because it suggests that second quintet's influence was broader than one might initially expect. And as it turned out, Kenny Cox said that Herbie Hancock changed his life. He changed the way he wanted to play. He was happy to be a bop player, and then that second quintet came along, and it kind of turned him completely around. So I asked Charles about this stuff because Charles is. He likes bebop, and he plays bebop. He plays fast. He's really good at it. He's still really good at it. And he has a kind of interesting take on modal stuff, the second quintet, as compared to bebop. And he argues or says that bebop, and we all know this, bebop demands a kind of virtuosity. It requires a really developed rhythmic sense. And in his words, it's kind of tricky. I love that. Playing bebop, it's kind of tricky. And
understatement of the year.
I know. And his feeling, and apparently the feeling of a lot of players when Miles' second quintet came out, was the modal stuff was just a little bit easier to play. I know that it was, you know,
yeah.
I'm just telling you, I'm just reporting that it was, sure. that it was, in terms of virtuosity, it was somewhat simpler, you know, that Miles became a kind of colorist rather than this fiery player of intricate lines related back to the head. So that's a kind of view. And this is the most fascinating thing Charles said, which I thought, I mean, so this just shows you how times have changed, right? There was a view that he felt was kind of widespread at the time that for a lot of people, the modal stuff was actually easier for the public to understand that bebop was difficult. And then the modal stuff allowed people kind of more relaxed window into the music. And so I've always felt exactly the opposite. Like I've always found modal music harder to connect to.
Well, but
and bebop was easier, you know, so that's interesting. Right. I mean, I don't know what your take on that is, but you know, he said that there was a feeling among some players that part of why modal started to replace bebop was just that people could understand it better.
You know, there are a lineage of players who very much work in modal playing. And of course, a lot of people, the Adam Baum of that movement, even if it wasn't the first, was kind of blue, right?
Yeah.
And that is, you look at the head for Freddy Freeloader or whatever, or all blues, and it is very, the chords are very simple. And it's about kind of the ability, how lyrical can you be?
Right.
How creative can you be within this very limited rule set, right? You're not generating lines based on ever-shifting harmonies. But, you know, I don't know if you look at Wayne Shorter's writing, it is not modal in that sense. I guess you could play it sort of, if you do harmony a lot better than I do, which is not hard to do, you might be able to figure out through the thicket of the strange chords he's put together, lines that would have notes in common across several of them. But his playing to me doesn't quite have that feeling. Some of the pieces, you know, do fall into that kind of loping groove, but, you know, I don't think of the second quintet as per se a modal outfit.
Right.
You know, whereas you think of Coltrane at the Village Vanguard, where I've said repeatedly, you know, reminds me a little bit in certain ways of rock and roll. I mean, it is. It's like there are two chords or three chords. And it is, I think it is easier to follow, and it is closer to what became rock. And I don't know. I mean, I think that you can get as creative results either way. I think it's more of a challenge to be real creative on some of the bebop lines because the temptation there is to kind of work on the technique and be able to kind of thread the needle, but then in a sense you end up spelling out the chords, which, you know, it's hard to do much other when there's so many of them and the key signature is changing all the time. I mean, it's a challenge to kind of come up with something that's not a pattern based on these shifting harmonies. So yeah, it's interesting because I don't think of, I mean, with the changes in tempo and the kind of playing with freedom that that second quintet had, I don't think of them as modal.
Right.
But certainly Shorter's harmonies are very oblique, and I would certainly agree that, and I've said this before at length, we don't need to go into it again, that Miles' soloing over Shorter's writing does take certain shortcuts and does kind of skate around all the complications going around. There's lots of little chromatic licks and coloristic interjections. I mean, I don't think that it is, and I've said this before at length, where Miles is most comfortable as an improviser. I mean, period. Now, Herbie and Shorter and Tony and Ron, they're all thriving there. Anyway, so, but how about in terms of Kenny here? This is, yeah, I mean, I absolutely like you. I mean, listening to this, I'm thinking, holy shit.
Isn't it uncanny? It is uncanny. I mean, it's just amazing. So it's the trumpeter who kind of brought this groove to these five guys. The trumpeter, sorry, I should say who the personnel are. I have it. The personnel are Charles Moore on trumpet, whom I don't know. And then Joe Henderson's younger brother, he's the one name I've heard of here. Leon Henderson is on tenor sax. Kenny Cox on piano, Ron Brooks on bass. I guess I've heard of Ron Brooks. And Danny Spencer on drums. So all Detroit guys, some of whom played in high school together, you know, they all kind of knew each other. But it was Moore who kind of brought this to the group, these ideas. And then they just kind of take it and run with it, don't they? And I don't know what you think, but would you say that Moore, or would you say that Moore on trumpet is like, well, I guess it's hard to deny, a more energetic player than Miles is?
Yeah, he's probably, again, not to beat a dead trumpet player, but yeah, I he seems a little bit more comfortable and technically secure and aggressive in this mold. Now, again, so much, especially of the studio stuff the group did, the quintet, Miles' group, is kind of based on, you know, moods and floating, evanescent kind of stuff. And, you know, Miles is really fucking good at that. Right. I mean, you can't really fight him on those terms. But whenever Moore is getting more aggressive pieces where he's playing faster, maybe playing a little higher, maybe playing a little louder.
Or just is stronger,
exactly.
You know, like the opener Mystique is kind of a showboat for him, and lots of oblique playing, lots of fast runs. You feel like you're in the hands of someone who's with Miles, I love his punctuations. I love his coloring. I love the things he does. But with Moore, you sort of feel like someone's in the driver's seat and we're going somewhere. I feel like an intense sense of confidence when he plays. I don't know. Whereas with Miles, it's always a high wire act.
Right. And again, arguably that group was really being led as much by Shorter and Hancock as it was by Miles. And he was a facilitator, and the name, the brand, and, you know, part of the aesthetic, you know, he's got an amazing fingerprint, amazing presence as a player in every phase. But yeah, this is not him at his strongest. I don't know, even health-wise, it was him at his strongest.
Right. Well, we should probably stop talking about them and just tell me what you thought of this. I hope you liked this disc, because I actually liked this quite a bit.
I actually ran across it myself a few years ago. I not listened to it extensively. I did enjoy it. It is really striking. The other thing I thought of glancingly once or twice was Wynton Marsalis's early quintet that we talked about. Whereas you get there at a much further remove, instead of 3 years after ESP, 30 or whatever, or 20, I guess, somebody taking on that legacy. You begin to wonder, was Miles's great second quintet, the one that sold so few albums, sort of the velvet underground of jazz, and that the few people that bought the albums were inspired to go out and try these techniques for themselves, kind of thing, whereas the general public didn't quite suss it.
Exactly. I remember years ago when I saw the Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra in Iowa, and it was just Armstrong, Parker. They were just doing the old Monk. And then they busted out something by the second quintet. It's like one nod. And I'm like, that's okay with him. That's as far as he'll go. After that, the apocalypse.
Oh, I see. Right. That's Wenton's kind of furthest. Yeah, right. Absolutely.
After that, no more. But that's, you know, we're still okay in the second quintet. And yeah, I think you're right. That's a good way of putting it. The velvet underground of jazz, you know.
Maybe. I don't know. But here it is. It is amazing. I mean, because I almost felt like I could, if I'd sat down long enough, and I didn't do this, but that you could kind of map much of the first album by this group onto ESP, the debut by the quintet, and just say, this is a song that's kind of like that song. Right down to kind of a loping three ballad that's introspective to faster, you know, just really it is a sound of a very young group who's found a model and is emulating it at a very high level. I mean, this is good playing. I think I'd say that just slightly, the rhythm section or maybe the whole feel of the group is just a little bit more earthbound. They don't quite have the miraculous float.
It's partly it's you can't replace Tony Williams.
Right.
This drummer is good.
Yeah.
But Tony is fucking otherworldly. Right. He can control that group with just writing a cymbal. He doesn't have to do anything else. So yeah, I'd agree with you about the rhythm section. I'd say that's probably fair. Have you heard Leon Henderson in other contexts?
Every time I've heard Wayne Shorter, maybe? My God. Yeah, I mean, even much more so than Moore, obviously, in a sense, is working in these parameters, familiar from Miles's group. He's doing some of Miles's gestures, but he is unmistakably a stronger player, you know, bolder, and, you know, probably not as brilliantly nuanced or emotive. Henderson, my God, he sounds so fucking much like Shorter. I mean, it is uncanny.
It is uncanny.
It really is. And it's got to do with, you know, Shorter's got this very vocalized cry to his sound. It's a very flexible embouchure. I sometimes kind of imitate it when I'm playing by myself with my little iPad. Not very well. And it has to do with that willingness to kind of, you're bending around notes. More so, it's a more idiosyncratic and vocalized sound than, say, Coltrane, who, if you listen to early Shorter, the first couple of albums on Blue Note, he sounds a fair amount like Coltrane. And then it gets more and more distinctive.
Right.
But the Henderson, just you think, well, is he going to just sound like a carbon copy of Jones? Like, nope, he sounds a lot like Shorter.
fuck Big Brother, I found someone else, you know?
Joe is such a identifiable player, too. He's got his own licks, his own crotchets, his own sound. But yeah, his brother is a Wayne Shorter man through and through. And so it is, I think that's the one thing. This is amazing and it's pleasant. And in some ways, it's the most accessible music on tonight's show. And I liked it.
Yes.
It is, yeah. But though I would say Shannon is, well, when we get to Shannon, it's one of the calmer entries in his canon. But there's this weird sense of you wish they could have stayed together for 10 years instead of two.
Uh-huh.
And gotten a little bit on it from that shadow. Because in jazz, you're always uncomfortable when it sounds like somebody is, let's say, very, very closely emulating somebody else, right? It's a oogie moment. You don't like to hear that in jazz. You want to say, this is a music of individuals, and I'm starting to get this person's, we like to say, fingerprint or identity or whatever, personality. And I, at times on this album, both in the compositions and the presentation and the sound of Henderson, it's sounding uncomfortably close to Dolly the Sheep version of the Great Quintet. So that was my only, that. And like I said, they're not quite, they're very, very, very good instead of absolute best in class, though you could argue that more in certain ways. I mean, it's kind of, you're giving with one hand and taking away with another with Moore versus Miles. Right. He certainly can do things Miles does not do. And then there's certain things that Miles can do that he can't, but that's what made Miles Miles. So.
Yeah, the whole band. So let's see the compositions here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 by Cox, 2 by Henderson, and then 1, 2, 3, 4 by Moore. So they had 3 writers in the band. They only have 1 cover by David Dura. I don't know who that is. I have no idea who that person is. You is the cover. But everything else is these guys composing. And given how young they are, that they've kind of grokked the second quintet and they're composing in this mode. Yeah, wouldn't it have been cool to hear these guys 10 years on? Because I assume they'd develop, they'd change. Who knows what they would have done? But with 3 competent writers, none of these songs are standards, but they're good. With 3 competent writers, where would they have ended up? Like, what would have happened to these guys? Where would their final careers have taken them? One wonders. Well, it's just fascinating. We've never had, or maybe we have done this, but one of the things in jazz is we tend to look at mountain peaks, and sometimes it's good to go into the valleys where players were looking to the mountain peaks and trying to do their own versions of the mountain peaks. And these are 5 young guys, and they've kind of mastered this idiom. They've got it.
Which is impressive. 10 years. I mean, it's not easy.
It is,
that was in a sense with a hyper technical achievement. What Marsalis was peddling back in the early 80s was, that we've mastered this very abstruse kind of tonal jazz, right? In a sense, it's kind of the last step before things get a little wiggy and a lot of people start running in fear. That said, of course, even Miles, who was one of the great brands in sense of jazz, was not able to move many units with his group. So it was hard for the general public to kind of get their minds around, and presumably an unknown piano player from Detroit on a smaller label like Blue Note, there's a couple efforts. Blue Note would be often do this. They would say, well, we'll kind of give anybody we think is decent a chance or two and put their stuff out. And then they don't really have the equipment or the staff or the reach or the finances to kind of say, and we're going to make this happen. They kind of put them out there. And if something caught on, it caught on. If enough units moved, they put another one out. But if nothing happened, they kind of walked away. I mean, understandably, they really didn't have a choice at that size operation. But yeah, they weren't going to make a star of somebody in a sense.
And, compare that to their operation now where they, put their eggs in a few baskets and they'll promote the hell out of someone who's now part of the stable. But otherwise, it's not like they have a broad reach. A Kenny Cox today is not going to get heard. And the fact that he got heard is kind of a little bit of a miracle.
Well, or he'd be on a steeplechase, or he'd be self-published, or he'd be, I think that.
Which he eventually did, by the way. Okay. He started his own record label to kind of get us, because he was not moving to New York. He stayed in Detroit. He performed with a whole bunch of generations of Detroit musicians. James Carter played with him. Regina Carter played with him. Craig Taborn played with him. So he stuck around Detroit and he started his own label. But yeah, he got discovered, or the way they got this sort of out was, according to the liner notes here, which is kind of fascinating. Someone from Detroit, it was a DJ, a Detroit DJ, told Duke Pearson about them. And Duke Pearson went out and heard them, and he kind of was the one who clued Blue Note in. So it was like, they're this group, they're in Detroit, they're doing what they do, a DJ likes them, the DJ says something to someone says something to Blue Note.
And Pearson, was kind of their A&R man at that time.
Exactly. That's how it happened.
right. Well, I guess the next one chronologically would be this early release by Oliver Lake, Prophet, from 1980. And I ran across his name first with the World Saxophone Quartet. He's probably not the best known member of that group.
No, he's not. Would you say he's the least known, probably?
Possibly.
Hemphill's everyone's favorite.
Obviously, Murray was just insanely
and
prolific.
And Hemi Blewett has his just
flirted with a kind of
endless projects.
Right.
So, yeah, maybe Ollie's. Yeah, maybe Ollie's the least. I shouldn't say Ollie. I don't know him.
Right. Yeah, I wouldn't. Yeah, having seen him perform, I wouldn't want to.
You're not going to cross him.
Try any nicknames on him. He looks like a serious dude. No, I don't think so. I think he plays a little flute right. at times, but mainly he is somebody who sticks for the most part to alto sax. He is not that he can't play other horns, but his identity is pretty much on that instrument. And he clearly owes a big debt to Dolphy. And I felt sometimes that in terms of actually liking to listen to albums, he's kind of up there for me. I don't know that he's the most striking or super wildly creative of the group, the World Sax Quartet, but in terms of just making listenable records that kind of straddle inside and outside, I like his stuff as much more of his, certainly small group stuff, I probably like better than Murray.
I might agree with that. Not Hemphill. I like Hemphill's stuff a whole bunch. I prefer Hemphill's solo efforts, or, you know, his groups to Lake's. Lake's a little astringent for me.
Yes. Yeah, he has got a tone that you have to kind of tangle with. And the album I had as a kid for many, many years was Expandable Language, which I think one of the Eubanks brothers appears on a guitar. And there's like one or two just really out songs. And the rest of it, again, is this kind of interesting zone where there is recognizable melody and arrangement. But Lake will go out. Lake is somebody that is willing to growl and scream on the instrument. You know, when I saw him play live at a couple of different points for sounds, he would shake his horn, which to me just looks terrifying. It's like, I don't want that to move when it's in my mouth. How do you do that, Oliver?
So many things to say, but I won't say any of them.
And this piece of very hard plastic slamming against your teeth does, I'm sure he's, and the other thing, he'd like strike his saxophone, kind of roll his hand physically down the keys as he was sweeping along the horn. So he had some kind of non-traditional extended techniques just in terms of interacting with the horn, much less blowing into it. So he can get very dry and very abstract. I think this is a fairly accessible record that, again, is one of his two very explicit nods to Dolphy. And it's interesting to me that he did two quintet projects within the course of 16 years, both on Black Saint, that were both nods to Dolphy. I mean, that's, you know, in a guy who's put out a fair number of albums over the years, but it's not insanely prolific. It's kind of interesting. Clearly, he wanted that interest and debt to be known. So, did you like this one? Okay, I was thinking about, well, do I want to do the tribute, which is even more straightforward? Did I want to do Expandable Language? I felt like I knew that album so well, I wanted to try something newer. I felt like this was kind of maybe a little bit harder core Oliver to look at. What do you think of this one?
Well, so I'll compare it to the other Oliver Lake album that I know reasonably well, which is with one of his trio dates, I think on Hat Hut, called Zaki, which is him and his frequent drummer, I don't know how you say his name, Akloff is his last name, Fioron.
I'm going to say Fioron.
Fioron Akloff.
I like Fioron Akloff.
Fioron Akloff and a guitarist. And that shit's way the fuck out. I mean, really out. And this isn't that far out, but this is not pleasant for me. And listening to it was a little bit of a chore. It's recorded, the way it's mic'd, his playing is incredibly dry. Like he's playing in a cedar chest in an attic somewhere. Oh, yeah. I mean, goddamn. Like there's no moisture in the sound here. The one that bugged me the most, maybe not bugged me, but it's like the song's called Something Sweet, Something Tender. And I think it needs to be renamed Something Sour, Something Hurtful. I mean, goddamn, that song is, I mean, it's a ballad, but it is. He's in Dolphy mode deluxe on this album. It is astringent, on the edge of painful for me oftentimes. Now, I like Dolphy, but Dolphy sometimes gives me a migraine. There are moments where I'm just like, oh, God damn it. can you just, Dolphy's, he's always a challenging, interesting player, and he always made other players. He challenged other players, right? Coltrane, some of his best discs are when he's playing with Dolphy. Mingus loved Dolphy. You know, he's just that guy. He's sort of uncompromising dude. And
so he's a reed biter.
He is a reed biter. He's a reed biter. I told you, Ron Carter, in an interview, said he kept having to change the tuning in order to fucking keep to keep Dolphy in tune. Everyone kind of had to adjust, you know, because
tighten those strings were on. Right. No, higher.
And man, like, he can really hurt my ears sometimes on this album. It's challenging. It is good, but it's demanding. I do not find this pleasant or easy. I almost find the free jazz easier, and I was trying to think why that is. The free jazz on Zaki it's just way out, and there are virtually no in moments, and
right,
so your ears are trained to listen to it differently. This is enough in that, like, when I hear something called Something Sweet, Something Tender, I'm kind of waiting for a ballad, and then my ears are assaulted and challenged throughout. It's just, it's a tough listen. I think his playing, for example, on that ballad is wonderful, but God damn, I don't need to hear it again for a while, I have to tell you. So I didn't find this pleasant, and I actually found the moments where he dropped out and the trumpeter soloed to be a little more easy on my eardrums. The trumpeter here is Bakita Carroll, and I really liked the songs where Carroll went to flugelhorn. So, yeah, this is a tough listen for me. I do appreciate
it. You want Oliver to play flugel sax, don't you?
You know,
especially modified.
The only thing that would have made this more painful would have been to have, like, Hamiet Blewett on bass clarinet. That would have really just fucking killed me.
I thought you were going to say two alto front line with Jackie McLean, but yeah, okay.
Oh, God. Just imagining that would have been a nightmare for the rhythm section, right? How the fuck would you play?
What was that Joe Jackson song? You gotta look sharp.
Yeah.
You gotta play sharp. Yeah,
play
okay.
Really sharp.
Whoa.
So, you know, I do think this is good. I think at times it's great, but goddamn, it's a challenge. It's demanding. It's not gonna... This is music that you can't sort of have on low in the background. You know, when I had these things on, you know, I've said before, I put these things in a big mix and I just rotate them while I'm doing other stuff. Kenny Cox, I'm so into the second quintet. That's just like, slipping into bed, you know, comfortable. Jimmy Lyons was his own particular kind of challenge. And Vonnell Chan and Jackson was surprisingly comforting. But every one of these was just like someone squirted some lemon juice in the milk. I was like, God damn, just made me sit up. And, you know, it's hard to do anything else when this is on. You just kind of got to concentrate and brace yourself for the next squall. So, yeah,
he will squall.
I didn't find this pleasant listening. I found it good listening, but demanding. It's not my favorite disc by him. And I like him better in other. This is not my favorite disc by him. It's good, but I'm not coming back to this for a while.
And yeah, I guess I'm more comfortable with the inside outside, the tension. I kind of like the framework that's sometimes recognizable, and then I'm willing to let the musicians in that framework push things really hard.
Right.
And to me, that bothers me less sometimes. Not that I'm bothered by completely free playing, but like when I saw him live with this really excellent drummer and piano player, it was very good, but it was all watching a conversation. I mean, there was nothing other than their interactions with one another and the moment by moment thing. And it was very dry. It was very well done. And sometimes he was just pure sound and sometimes it was more melodic playing, but that's engaging on its own terms, but it kind of takes out to me the tension between the popular and the art sides of jazz, right? It becomes pure art. There's no populist cyclical form. There's no melody. There's none of that stuff that you kind of get from the side of the folk music where it's, you kind of know where you are. There's a repetition. There's something familiar. So, you know, yeah, this is maybe not my favorite record. I think that in some ways his later tribute to Dolphy is an easier going listen. He might be slightly more in tune there. I'm not sure. You know, just a little, and it might have been recorded a little more gently. It's by no means a glossy kind of mid-90s Blue Note sounding record, but it's maybe a little softer in outline than this. Yeah, he's got Donald Smith on piano. Jerry Harris on.
Did you like the piano player? I did kind of like him. He obviously reminds me often when he goes out of Cecil Taylor, but he's fairly restrained for the most part. Oliver's doing all the heavy lifting here, it seems to me.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of these mini sessions where I said felt like that was good. I don't know that there was something that caught my ear where I started thinking about who is this guy. So I enjoyed it. I thought it was an interesting choice to have an electric bass played by Jerry Harris.
Yeah.
And he also would play with electric guitar, as I mentioned, on Expandable Language, which is a session I've been kind of fond of, though it does have a song or two that is just out. And then some of the rest of it is more accessible stuff. So he's somebody who's willing to kind of mix things up with a little bit of electricity, maybe not too much, which is probably ideal. But yeah, again, I don't know that anybody else here made me want to say, I'm going to look at the back of this album and go out and look for a recording by that person.
Right.
I enjoyed them all. I think it was all well done, but I didn't quite get to that level. Now that may just be a function of not having listened to it enough, because this was really one that I maybe listened to once or twice before, but had not immersed myself in by any stretch. Anyway, yeah, Quintet. I've enjoyed him. I did notice, as I said, when I saw him live, and he's in his 70s now, I guess, that, you know, he's an uncompromising dude. He's a serious guy. I think he smiled twice in 2 hours of playing. And, you know, the drummer was meanwhile having little orgasms every time he did another weird sound on his kit. And he was a lot of fun. He was doing very well. Both the other players were fine. It wasn't quite going to school, but it was at the serious end of what I want to hear.
Right.
And there is, you know, he will do a lot of gurgling, extended techniques, squawking. And I guess I want to make a shout out. I think the last piece on the Lake Project on Prophet, where it's just kind of him playing by himself meditatively and the piano comes in. I like that piece. It is maybe still a little bit astringent, but I find it kind of contemplative and a good mood changer. As we transition maybe for Ready to Jimmy Lyons, yep. You know, one thing that strikes me, he is maybe not quite, in certain ways, as committed to those devices. He'll use them occasionally, but he is more, in certain ways, a straightforward player, even though this album is considerably more abstract.
Yep.
Interesting ensemble, drums, bass, and three frontline musicians. I thought you might enjoy the fact that includes, is it Enrico Raba?
It does.
Is that how you'd say that?
That is correct. Good job.
Borca on bassoon. For a little while, she was in his quintet, because there's at least one other recording I've got with her on it. And I thought, well, I'm going to pick this one because Raba's on it. He's a known name. Jay Oliver on bass, and then Paul Murphy, who I think does a fine job on drums, mostly cymbals and snares. He leaves that lower octave for the bass player to enjoy. He's not really hitting toms or bass drum much.
Right.
And yeah, this is more, I think of as, maybe you like this better than I did, kind of hardcore, not pure, what does freedom even mean? Fairly free jazz, right? I mean, it's kind of, I think of as a more, play a couple note motif and just kind of talk with one another. Somebody steps forward in solos and they step back. Sometimes all three of the front line are playing, occasionally get a full bass solo, but kind of an ongoing conversation rather than what I think of as a song per se.
Yeah.
So you like this one better or worse than
I do like it better than Oliver. Yeah. And it's all about the bassoon for me, because she played with Lions for years. And then I just looked this up. She played with William Parker, Cecil Taylor, Bill Dixon. So that's like a who's who of pain right there.
That's right.
To me, she's the most striking thing here. I remember her licks better than I remember Jimmy's. And the bassoon sounds kind of like bass clarinet, but it's different, right? It's got this sort of reedier. It's weird. It's got the depth, but it sounds reedier. The bass clarinet sounds sort of woodsier. Love it. I love this sound. I on Give It Up, especially the opener, I dig that number, man. I that's 10 minutes of confusion, but man, her squalling on that is a blast. I don't know that she's the thing that sticks out for me. Jimmy Lyons is a bit difficult for me to get into. He's the guy, am I right in thinking he's the guy who plays a lot or has played a lot with Andrew Cyril, or is that a different drummer he often worked with?
Well, again, I guess the connection I know best is that he worked a lot with Cecil Taylor.
Right.
In terms of his own stuff, he has certainly recorded sessions as a leader, but he's not that widely documented apart
right.
from Cecil. So I don't know. Yeah, he may have had a connection with a particular drummer. I don't know his career well enough. I mean, that was one reason I kind of picked this, is I thought, well, I should make myself get a little bit more deeply into this.
Right. Yeah. So this is definitely out, and it's less, I think it has more accessible moments than the most difficult Cecil Taylor stuff. And there are moments where people drop out, and, you know, like I'm thinking of on Give It Up, everyone kind of gets their chance to shine at different points. And Jimmy Lyons playing is a relief after Oliver Lakes. He doesn't seem to bite the reed as much. He lives more at the lower register. And that's meant, he does go up, but he's willing to explore the lower register of the horn, which is nice. It makes a nice link to the bassoon playing here. So those are the things that I noticed the most. I don't not care for the trumpeter, but Enrico Rava, I don't know. He's not what I remember here most. He will play really fast sometimes. Do these little fluttery riffs and stuff. I don't know if it's how he's mic'd. He seems a little quieter than the other frontline players. I don't know if that's by design. I didn't dislike it. It's just he's not what I remember here. I really remember the goddamn bassoon and want to hear more. I do like the low instruments, especially when they're given a chance to do stuff. And to me, the bassoon is a revelation, because unlike, you know, say the tuba, you can play it really fast.
But should you?
Which is kind of cool. It's kind of cool. I take it you didn't like that as much.
Am I right that Rava kind of got more centrist?
I think that's fair. We've done one of his discs,
exactly,
Blood on the Dance Floor.
He was going to cover Michael Jackson with Jimmy Lyons, but then he decided he wouldn't. So, I guess I'm wondering if this was him exploring, which is pretty common for European jazz musicians, frankly, this really out mode and then finding his own voice maybe a little closer in. Yeah, well, Borka's interesting, obviously, in a sense. I thought, well, let's, you know, if we're going to have an unusual quintet, maybe one, you know, certainly bassoon is fucking unusual, right? You know, that's not a front line you're going to run across very often. So it seemed like a good reason to include this. I remembered I had a couple Lions albums with quintets with a bassoon on them. You know, I don't know. It's a querulous sound, right? Kind of grumbly, as if it's maybe one of the voices in Charlie Brown, one of the adults, right?
You know? That's good. I like that.
And I guess for me, and I mentioned this about bass players. You know, I don't like bass players much who mumble. In other words, they play licks so quick that I have trouble distinguishing what the notes are. And this will happen on some trombone players do this too. You know, they'll go really just they play the 16th or 32nd note figure, but the nature of the register they're in, just the propagation of notes of that size, literally of that wavelength, unless they're just geniuses at articulation, it kind of smears together. It's kind of, you know, and to me, that's just not very interesting or expressive. I'd rather just play it slower. I mean, that you're going to express some kind of idea or feeling or whatever, musical thought, more effectively. And when you're just running up and down, unless you are just a genius and you can really make the notes work individually, it becomes a smear. Now, sometimes, I mean, that's the goal, right? Cheats the sound or whatever. So I had a little trouble following her when she played. That said, it was an interesting. I think I like bass clarinet a lot more so far. That's the kind of sound and tonality that I can kind of soak in. And you know, if I'm listening to a symphony or something, bassoon can be gorgeous. And in fact, I went to a performance. I think it was this last night. My God, yeah, time goes quickly. That had some contrabassoon that was just amazing. You know, floor shaking stuff. And yeah. There it is, in a sense, and this is kind of the pleasure she brings to this gig in a different way, is the texture, right? It is almost more texture than tone.
Yes.
So I don't know. I found it a bit quarrelsome. I don't know that it's something that I want to – I think it probably bothered me more than legs playing in terms of just whatever the person's expressing. I'm not sure that this particular sound being made right now is one that I like. But – fascinating. I mean, what the hell? You know, who? It's just kind of amazing to hear a group like this where one of the voices is a bassoon. And there's, I like the fact that they'll go from all three playing in polyphony and just kind of improvising together, and then maybe one emerging and then another. You know, there's a lot of kind of shifting around. It's not just, say, a blowout where everybody's just going full tilt for 20 minutes kind of thing. Yeah, Lyons, maybe I have to keep listening to him. This may be finally a little bit regressive, a little bit palate is too strong, or maybe, you know, too negative. But yeah, I don't know that he's catching my ears as much as he might have. And maybe he's not, you know, maybe he is a brilliant, he's best as a sideman. I don't know, because he's certainly on a lot of classic performances by Cecil, right? Some of his most important recordings feature Jimmy. So, it's a mixed bag. I don't know this one I'll go to a lot. I also listened to The Follow-Up, which is another group that it features Borka, but a different trumpet player. But I thought, well, we kind of know Rava, so let's throw him in there. Well, any other thoughts on Lyons before we move on here?
I know him, like I said, best. I think I have the Cyril duo date. I know him from those other settings, and I don't know him well enough yet to be able to have a full grasp on him and his stuff. I think I have heard him on several Taylor discs, but to me, those are always Taylor discs. I mean, he just dominates the proceeding. So I don't have a good feel for Lyons as a player yet. But I did like the personnel and the texture here quite a bit. And it was good pairing it with Lake, because if this was the hardest thing, it might irritate my ears the most. But with Lake in the mix, this almost felt like a relief.
Well, it's interesting because, to me, structurally speaking, Lake's album, six songs, most of them are songs. You know, there is a kind of, it is more mainstream in many ways. I mean, a couple of them are Dolphy numbers, for fuck's sake. Whereas this is more purely abstract improvisation. You know, there's a little fanfare kind of thing. But it's not like you're saying, oh, groovy, I'm going to be humming that tonight. You know, it's pretty much an occasion to begin the conversation. All right, the final selection, Ronald Shannon Jackson's Shannon's House, and it comes in 1996, which is towards the very end of a fairly prolific, I finally looked up his discography and not realized that for about 16 years there, he put out more than an album a year. It's not like two every year, but you know, more than 16 albums in 16 years. And then kind of fell off the face of the earth. As a kid in college, I just ran across one of his best distributed and frankly, one of the best covers ever put together for one of his records, Decode Yourself, and mm-hmm. enjoy that record. And I've ended up with 5 or 6 of his things now. And I kind of went through some of them. I've learned you don't listen to 3 Ronald Shannon Jackson albums in a row. At least if you're me, you don't, because at some point, that's a little too much Ronald. But this is towards the end of his recording career, and it's, I don't know, I think in some ways he loses some of his characteristic moves. I mean, one thing he'd love to do would have horn lines that were almost like the horns were playing in completely different keys. And so there's this weird tension to them. I mean, what's being played might be kind of a pretty accessible rock, almost groove, and the horns are playing this angular melody over it, but they're also not playing it in harmony. They're playing it kind of opposed to one another. And it's just a very distinctive sound. And I kind of like it. This is a little much of a departure from it. And then he brings in a guitar player along with a reed player and a keyboard player who, I don't know, I tended to think of on this gig as more of a colorist. I don't know. What were your thoughts about this one?
He's almost not necessary, yeah. Is he? I guess he's necessary to the gestalt, but he doesn't really solo, no. Does he? He creates these textures. I was also struck. Shannon's playing is kind of on the nose a lot on this album, isn't it? He's not as frenetic as he often can be on the opener, Julius Is Gone, which is that a tribute to Hemphill? I have no idea. This album comes out in 1996. Did Hemphill just die? I mean, Julius is the Julius everybody knows. So I'm wondering if it's a Julius tribute. It's this kind of plaintive song, and the soprano saxophonist gets a lot of play over the noodling keyboards, and Ronald Shannon Jackson's playing is like on the number 1-3-1-3.
Yeah, Julius dies in 95, so it's very...
So I'm going to guess it's a tribute. Yeah.
Right, very plausible that would be.
Yeah, and I happen to like that number a lot. Sometimes the keyboards get on my nerves a little bit. I almost wish we didn't have them, although I kind of get what they're doing. They are creating a mood. It's just a little weird. These are electronic keyboards, right?
Right, they're kind of washes sometimes.
Yeah, it creates kind of a bedrock, I guess. I guess it's there for that reason. But yeah, I didn't feel like Shannon Jackson's playing was as crazy and out as it can get on this album, as we've heard on other occasions.
I'd agree, yeah.
What did you think? I wanted to ask you about a couple of the numbers in particular. So what did you make of the James Weldon Johnson cover, Lift Every Voice and Sing? Describe to the class, please.
I don't know that I can, because I don't know that I remember it distinctively enough.
I think they play the notes once or twice.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'd have to hear it played back. I just don't.
That's right. So I think I do believe once or twice they actually play the melody of that song, but it is as uncompromising as other stuff Shannon Jackson does. Again, I don't think he's the featured dude here. The guitarist is having a party. And it sounds a little bit like he's channeling Sonny Sherrock on this particular song. He's just squalling. And I believe they've overdubbed him. I believe we've got him playing over himself. I may be wrong about that. But it's a sort of squalling, screeching, 7-minute treatment of the James Weldon Johnson song, Lift Every Voice and Sing. And I don't think I ever hear the melody of the song in there. It's just an out. Shannon Jackson is sort of, you hear him doing some stuff on the cymbals, and he's a little bit on the kit, hither and yon here, but it's the guitar just fucking having a 7-minute workout.
Yeah.
Which I thought was funny, but also James Weldon Johnson could well ask, what the fuck? I mean, seriously, I defy someone to find the you know, original in there. I don't hear it. For some reason, this bothers me less than Nasty. I kind of like this. Even on Lift Every Voice and Sing, it slips into a kind of groove at a certain point. Jackson is busy, but not so busy that you can't kind of hear an overall structure. I don't know. I kind of dig it. So I want to hear more from you about what you thought of this album as a whole, though, because I found this surprisingly enjoyable after
Nasty.
what I assumed was going to be painful after Nasty.
And Nasty's pretty early. Just as I said, this was a guy that I really did not know well. Picked up this particular album way back as a kid, and then didn't really see him again in the bins or around. It was Island, I think, was the label that Decode Yourself was on. And it's a story, as I ran across stuff at used record stores year by year, of a guy that was on a lot of different labels. He never seemed to find a home, and whose work kind of morphed a little bit from year to year. But I tend to think of a lot of the earlier stuff as being interested in kind of avant funk, as we associate with people like Ornette Coleman in a certain stage.
Yes.
Somebody who would bring in certain Middle Eastern sounding tonalities. Now, I'm not saying that that was, you know, just sort of a bit of a tinge of that. Somebody who's not afraid to use kind of rock rhythms and pretty populous structures. I mean, a lot of the songs are pretty, in a certain way, straightforward. But somebody who liked kind of harmonic writing for the horns, and that, again, as I say, you have lines played on a couple saxophones that just don't harmonize in a traditional way. It was like Ornette not knowing that when you play alto, it's a transposition instrument, and you play, you know, different notes when someone says B-flat than the B-flat on the saxophone. She just played B-flat. And so that weird sound of is like both straightforward and accessible, but out too, and dissonant and kind of an edge to everything. And, you know, it varies from one to one. I was impressed. I was listening to Oh Man Dance, which I had not listened to much. And Man Dance is an album by him that has this huge muscular arm on it with some kind of red streaks. It's very abstract, but it kind of reminds you of a bloody severed arm. I don't think that was the goal, but it kind of evokes that. And the album's called fucking Man Dance, which doesn't, you know, particularly appeal to me. I'm not sure what that means. I guess it's ideal for the Wood anniversary. And it's actually a really good album with some interesting textural alleyways it goes down. I never feel like I listen to a Ronald Shannon Jackson album and it's about like a lengthy drum solo or even about him being super technical on the kit. I mean, you hear more from like early King Crimson, from Giles. I mean, he's doing amazing thing, you know, exactly. Or, you know, obviously you need Tony Williams or whatever. He's kind of a fairly straightforward, ebullient, pile-driving kind of guy. But as a conceptualist, I kind of find him interesting. I've kind of liked his stuff. But this is, I feel like, yeah, it is more, this quintet sounds more like a traditional quintet to some degree. The songs seem a little bit more traditional. It's very much about guitar with some assist from the sax. As we've said, the keyboards are just washes. And it's probably recorded a little bit more professionally, might be. I don't know. You know, it's kind of a recording, and that may have to do with its era, right? I think the mid-90s were an era of softening. They weren't interested in audio verite particularly. They didn't want things to sound like you're in the room with them unmediated. They wanted to kind of shave off the edges. And this is not an extreme version. I don't think this is offensively kind of muffled or something or sweetened up to the point where it doesn't have any bite, but it is a smoother sounding record than Nasty. Smoother sounding than some of the other LPs I've got from him from other areas, other eras, that 16-year span. So yeah, I think it's, in some ways, it's certainly the most accessible. I mean, I don't know that you quite get what's as weird and distinctive about him as you would on like Decode Yourself or Man Dance. But it is, if you want to get to know his work and you want to kind of, you're coming at it from the right to some degree, it'd be a great starting place. And the question is, do you want to get nastier or not? It's right. Your call. And if you don't like that dense harmonic funk, then some of the earlier stuff is not going to be to your taste, because it is more like that.
Right. And this doesn't have that. It doesn't have that dense harmonic funk. This isn't actually that funky. It's more, what would you compare it to? I'm trying to think of things I compare it to. Maybe a little bit to, this will sound like a slightly odd comparison, but several of the numbers, I'm thinking Supernatural, Ashes. They remind me a little bit of Love Supreme, Psalm, where you sort of just have that kind of squalling statement, and it's more about this sort of, It reminded me moments of cult. They remind me, this quintet reminds me of moments of Coltrane where he's searching out, where he's sort of, you know, reaching toward the divine, right? And I don't know if they would accept that as a description of what happens here, but these are dense washes with the guitar and the saxophone competing. And these kind of squalls of notes reaching out, trying to get something, get to something. And so the songs don't have a kind of beginning, middle, end. They have a kind of mood. They set a mood. They kind of stretch and reach for something almost. That's how several of the numbers sounded to me on this particular album. So I'm gonna say that this has a weirdly, this isn't quite the right word, but it has this weirdly religious questing energy, maybe a little bit like Coltrane, maybe a little bit like some of Albert Eiler's stuff,
but much smoother. But yeah, sure.
Yes, but sort of grasping and stretching.
One or two of the songs, yeah, kind of sound gospel-y to some degree. You know, I mean, there is,
they do,
yeah, a little hymn-like.
And I take it some of the songs, I mean, the names of the songs, we've had talks about names of songs before, but the names kind of back up a little bit of what I'm saying. The opener is this, I presume, lament for Julius Hemphill, and then a hymn for Mandela, Midnight Sermon. Lift every voice and sing, supernatural. There's a kind of religious mood here, in spite of the instrumentation that might sound out and frenetic. And oddly, the song that doesn't sound like one is the last song, Rochella's Lament, which doesn't sound very much like a lament, although I'm sure Rochella is playing sax for all he or she is worth there. It sounds kind of unlamenty to me.
Yeah.
The title there is a little misleading. But.
And he's born in 40. So he makes his album when he's 56 years old. And yeah, I think it is a little bit, you know, it's got that more meditative feel of middle age. He's not a young man. He's not quite as pushing as he might have been earlier. But yeah, 96 or 98, he goes back to Texas. He dies in 2013. But really, things are pretty quiet after he goes back on the recording front. So yeah, this is kind of a winding up. And it to me, in a way, I always thought that, for me, he was an avatar of one of those many artists who I thought, you know, I kind of, that was kind of music of the future I wanted to hear, but no one else did, and it didn't catch on. All right. Well, I asked you to think just briefly about, you know, as we look back over the last year, every minute of which is precious. You know, Mike says he doesn't like to listen to these. I just love listening to them again and again. And we just both sound better every time.
I wish.
Wondered, you know, if we had to go back and pick three records out of the ones we've covered in the last year podcast.
Do we gotta?
Don't have to. I don't know if any jumped out at you or not. So I sent you the spreadsheet, which is.
And I totally forgot to look at it. So yeah, that's I'm bad. So I can tell you two jump to mind, but why don't you tell me your three and then that will help me. I already have two in mind, but do you tell me
and
your
we'll
three.
See. There may be some crossover. So I looked and I will say it is striking to me. I enjoy almost everything we listen to on this podcast to one degree or another. But if I go back and say, you know, was this a Stone classic? Is this one that just really struck me? There are fewer of those. So I picked, and I'm even a little torn about this, Melt Frame by Halvorsen, Mary Halvorsen.
Mm.
And in some ways, I probably like the Tomika Reid album with her better.
Mm.
But I think Melt Frame's probably the one that I like them both an awful lot. And they're some of my favorite Mary Halvorsen recordings and some of my favorite recent jazz recordings. But I felt like Melt Frame, just in terms of presenting a solo recital on electric guitar, was probably a little bit more central and more must hear. You know, I should go back and listen to this again. I thought, well, I guess I'll throw in Kurt Elling's Upward Spiral. I liked it a lot. I think mainly just based on that performance of the Sting song that we talked about at length on our podcast there. Yeah. Because I sometimes think that, you know, one really successful, really memorable performance of a song that, in a sense, I believe he should be, if he hasn't, adding to the jazz canon, is worth something in this day and age, right? I mean, yeah, that there's something on an album that you just say, my God, you know, this is a new standard. This is an amazing performance. And I felt like Branford was in a happy place the whole time. And I like that record. And then finally, for the reissue, I tried to look also, I'm saying, well, what about the newer stuff as much as I could? Picked the complete Village Gate recordings by Sonny Rollins just because it's a must hear. I don't know that it's all going to be pleasant for you. Some of it you may never want to hear again. Some of it may not be that revelatory at the end, but I just feel like if you're serious about listening to improvisation and improvisers working at a high level, you got to hear it. And a special mention, just honorable mention to Sonny Criss's Sonny's Dream. Mm. That whole episode 119 on the various Sonnies, I think all of those guys have good, strong work, and it's fun to hear. And it's kind of the stuff that maybe if you're poking around Spotify and you want to listen to somebody new and you haven't heard Fortune or you haven't heard Sonny Criss or even Sonny Stitt or Sonny Simmons, you know, look those names up because all of them did good work. So anyway, that was my thought.
That was a really good podcast, too, as I recall. That went really well.
I enjoyed it. Yeah, I think we're in the same room. It was really, really unusual.
Were we in this? Oh, that's right. That was at your dining room table. That was a good podcast. So I'd agree with you on Upward Spiral. That's my favorite disc of the year. Of course, that song, which I think is fucking amazing. But virtually everything on that disc really speaks to me. Elling's in a great place on that. And Marsalis, his accompaniment, it's just they enjoy a really good rapport. So I thought that was a really good one. I'm a little surprised that you did not pick Drunk by Thundercat. To me, one of the most memorable listens of the year, just an amazing amount of fun, a blast in every way. And he is a monster bass player. Just he is.
Yeah, maybe if they had a few more of those workouts, I would have liked a little more bass playing, a little bit less puffing on illegal substances. I guess not in California. So
he just cracked me up. I liked it a lot, but I don't know that I'd pick that one. I'll pick one that you would never pick, or one that you didn't like as much as I did. I am a sucker for pretty much everything Darcy James Arque does, and I thought Real Enemies was the shit.
Oh, okay.
I don't think it's as good as the other two we've done by him, Brooklyn, whatever, and the Babylon. One before that. Brooklyn, Babylon, and the first
Infernal
one.
Infernal Machines, I think.
Infernal Machines. They all can't be gold, but Jesus Christ, I thought that was a great album. That was some brilliant stuff. And I had a third one picked out, and it went right out of my head now. I was kind of skimming around here. Oh, duh. How do you not mention, what is wrong with you? How do you not mention Horace Tapscott's The Giant Has Awakened? What is wrong with you?
It was in the running. Yeah, definitely. That was another one that I was thinking about. And I got to admit, I didn't press it too hard, right? In other words, I think that obviously there are going to be more than three fine recordings. Yeah, I like that one a lot. That was the standout, I think, from our... Though, you know, Lenox Avenue Breakdown is quite good, too.
It is. And a great cover, as covers go.
Arthur Blythe is he's somebody else from that... I don't know if he's exactly the same age, but I think of that lost generation of people, I guess from roughly, you know, the era when I was a kid getting into jazz, who kind of steamrolled by the Young Lions movement and it maybe didn't get the recognition they deserved. So, yeah, obviously you want to listen to all those podcasts if you haven't already. They're all gold. But those are our recommendations there from the last year's worth, our last big trawl. And now we're looking forward to year six.
When somebody thinks you're wonderful, what a difference in your day. Seems as though your troubles disappear like a feather in your way.
So
and stop.
Okay,
I gotta say something. I have a thing to say. I have a rant.
Okay.
Make sure you put this in the podcast. So our listeners won't know, but you know, and I know that we had talked about doing this, I guess, for years before we ever got around to doing it. We must have been kicking it around for 3, 4, 5 years. Oh, we got to do this. Oh, we got to do this. We got to do this. And then suddenly one day you're like, we're doing it. And we started it. And I just wanted to get a little sentimental here, Pat. I just wanted to say, you know, my introduction to this music came through you and your idiotic playing of Steely Dan every morning for breakfast. And then I got into the music because you kind of got me interested in it when we were in college. And then I got into the podcast because you dragged me into doing it. It's kind of a replica of the conversations we sit around and have when we hang out. And so I'm just really grateful. I just wanted to say thanks for having the idea, and thanks for bringing it about. And thanks also, people don't know this, for the insane amount of hard work you do. All I do is show up and sound brilliant for 2 hours every 2 weeks, which is not really difficult for me. But you take these recordings, sometimes two, sometimes three, and then you splice them together and you cut out all of the ums. And I sound 10 times better than I do just in unguarded conversation. So thanks for all of the fucking hard work you do to make this happen, because I know it's, you put in hours for every one of these after we spend 2 hours talking. So thank you for all of that. I really appreciate it.
You know, you're welcome, but what happens with history is we tend to kind of airbrush the tough beginnings. And so what Mike doesn't like to discuss is my first suggestion was we do a podcast called Boys on the Beach, where each time we discussed a single Beach Boy song for 2 hours. And he just, yeah, we tried it, and he kept threatening suicide. We had to stop. But after that... But
for listeners out there, Pat still would like to do that. So if there's someone who gets wood to every unctuous note let out by Brian Wilson and the boys, please contact Pat as soon as possible. He would love to do a series of two-hour podcasts on one song by the Beach Boys. I think it would keep him going for years and years and years.
Salt Lake City will be coming soon. Oh, my Lord. Yeah, there's a sale on right now, these fancy remasters. And even I'm like, do I really need a 200-gram version of Surf's Up? Even I didn't pull the trigger on that one. So, yep, it's been a pleasure so far. I've you know, it's always fun to get together and talk with you. And yeah, the work is good for my OCD tendencies. And no one knows who listens to podcasts that I have Tourette's. And I just keep saying fuck a tree half the time. And I have to cut that out 70, 80 times a podcast. I don't know what it is about that. It just bursts out all the time. And whenever anyone says Microsoft, both of us start cursing uncontrollably, which is,
oh my God, strange. Are you going to put that rant in? Is there enough of it to put in? You should probably put it in at the end, me going off for 10 minutes on why I hate Microsoft.
God. So, Microsoft. Oh, my God. Skype is this beautiful little software flower. Who should we give it to tend and care for? How about Microsoft?
Mm.
Yeah, it doesn't grow bigger when you piss on it.
You miss me? I miss all of y'all. Hey! All y'all girls standing together like that. I can't take it.
Did you have any pop matters in mind you wanted to discuss?
God, I don't think so.
I know it's been crazy for you.
It's my life is a living hell of grading right now. So I'm just scanning back to see if there's been anything lovely and new in my life in the last 2 weeks. And the answer is, oh, there is. I will mention one thing. My goodness, I forgot about that. So, yeah, I've been using the All Music Annual Guides to just be my guide back in various genres of music that I don't often listen to, and I'll pick up things and decide if I want to hang on to them. And so, and they're my guide to jazz stuff too. Sometimes I'll see, oh, I haven't heard of that person. I'll dig them up. So they mention, I think I'm back to 2016 now or 2014, something like that, on pop stuff. And I picked up a Pharrell Williams Girl.
Okay.
My God, that's a good album. I don't know if you've heard the whole album. It's far less misogynistic than these outings tend to be, and it is just some happy pop. It's actually pretty good. I was kind of shocked on the first listen through. Some of my favorite songs are Hunter, Gush, Happy, Come and Get It, Bay. I'm like, wow, this is surprisingly good. I did not realize, you know, I'd heard of him, and I think I'd heard a song or two, but I think Happy was the only song I knew before getting the album. But
Gush might be a bit anatomical for me. But yeah, it's a fun record. I think Joyce's reaction though was, what is this crap? And so because I got it a while back. And yeah, he is an interesting pop craftsman. He definitely, he knows how to put together a song. Apparently sometimes he might borrow other people's parts when he does it, but that's pop music. No, I like the record. It's a lot of fun.
My mama done told me when I was in pigtails. My mama done told me, a man's gonna sweet talk and give you the big eye.
No real pop. I did see live Monday here. Malmo has kind of a jazz club that sets up shop in the Cuban performance space. And I have reviewed this on All About Jazz. I saw Isabella Lundgren. And she is a small young woman who her website kind of describes her as Billie Holiday-esque. And one of the tunes you can play, she's doing, you know, she sounds a little bit like Billie, and it's kind of about nuance and intensity. And then you get her in the room, and it turns out she's got a voice as big as a house. She's, you know, as I described her there, there's a little Barbara in terms of just power and range and kind of a tight vibrato. There's a little bit of Betty Carter maybe in terms of willingness to kind of bend lines. And unfortunately, most of what she sang was originals, and in the lyrics there's a little bit of Bjork. Lots of abstractions. It was weird because it was a Swedish gig, so she did all the speaking, and some of it went on for a while in Swedish, but then all the lyrics are in English. And most of them are originals and things like, "All Your Guns and Your Violence," or, you know, "My Cage of Loneliness," and I'm like, oh my God, no. But she's really good singer, really intense. I don't know, the melodies aren't that memorable, they're kind of good jazz grooves. And so I kind of enjoyed the singing, even though as someone who enjoys good uses of the English language, some of the lyrics seemed kind of awkward. And I don't know, just abstract to a degree that didn't work. Interestingly, she is still studying for a degree. Can you guess the area she's studying?
British literature.
Nope. Like Kurt Elling, she's in theology.
God. Wow. There's a book, Theology and Jazz.
It's kind of weird. It's like, she's going to be a priest. I'm like, is she going to be a priest in the Swedish Lutheran Church? Because by law, you have to remove all personality once you join that church, as far as I can tell. That's not fair, but it's very laid back. I was explaining to our pastor back home that American Lutheranism compared to Swedish Lutheranism is sort of like in the States comparing American Lutheranism to what I call the more excitable branches of fundamentalist. it's like to snake handling to American Lutheranism is American Lutheranism to Swedish Lutheranism. Very, very quiet religion. So anyway, yeah, she's good. I mean, she strikes me as somebody when she's singing, she's not bullshitting. It's intense. She's got a good voice. She did a couple, it's weird, she did a couple spiritual covers. She's pretty good at them. The group that she had a trio, and they were excellent. But I keep thinking, it's like, sometimes I feel like a motherless child. It's like, the whole point of that song is, think about it, it's an extraordinarily simple, direct, concrete image. I feel like this. Why don't you try that in your own writing? I'll talk about Cages of Loneliness. And she ended up by singing I Can't Give You Anything but Love, and found somebody in the audience who was having a birthday and kept singing it to her. It was very cute, but not, you know, it was the opposite of the Swedish Bublé, where I just felt like there's just no sincerity whatsoever to be found. This young lady might suffer from too much, but she's, you know, she's a good singer. And if you'd ever get a chance, I cannot imagine her transferring to the U.S. or succeeding here. I don't think that this audience is willing to take on somebody with a bit of an accent and somebody who occasionally isn't purely idiomatic in her use of language. I think we're too, I don't know, biased or stuck on our own cultural norms to do that. I mean, we're still hung up about ABBA 30 years later, right? So, I, you know, but she's serious talent. So that was neat. And I just want to share with you a theory. So I've been going to gym class here. I can't play basketball, but the block we live on, right there, there's this gym. And so I'm in classes. So you enroll for class. I mean, you know, it's like just a session. I'll go to this session. And they're leveled. And so it's like level one is the easiest, and then two, and then three. And I've been petitioning them for like a level zero where you just unroll the mat, listen to a story. But they won't do that for me. And so like in level one, Gympa, which is just kind of, I don't know, flexibility, some slight aerobic stuff. I rapidly learned the music they play includes things like Paul Simon, Phil Collins, and Eric Clapton. Ooh. So you just kind of want to die sometimes. It's mellow. I understand the purpose that BPMs are what you need to like slowly touch your foot from behind your neck or whatever. But so I went, you know, Gympa 2, which is about the edge of what I can do at this point, but I'm trying Gympa 2. And there I ran across a techno version of Sweet Home Alabama.
Nice.
I'm like, okay, Southern rock does not go this fast. It doesn't go. It's not the whole point of Southern rock is slower. And plus, do you know the complicated racial politics of this song? Do you have any idea what it's about? Do you realize that it's kind of a mind? No, we're in Sweden. You don't. You just technoed it, didn't you? And then they did another one that I cannot find on the internet. I don't know anything about country music, but it was some pop song about I just came here for the horses. And I'm sure it was another like techno version of some country song. So anyway, my theory is that the way they get you to move from level one to level two is to torture you with the music in level one. But when you get to level two, they make you question your whole existence by playing Sweet Home Alabama, techno style. I don't know what would be stranger than that. I can't think of an example.
Don't know.
So that's my report back from the front. I'm hoping to listen to the new Clientele album before next time, but
oh, right.
That hasn't happened yet. They're back after a hiatus, and they're still mellow, so hooray. And that concludes episode 130 of the Jazz Bastard podcast. As always, you can reach us at pat@jazzbastard.com or mike@jazzbastard.com. Check out our Facebook page, or if you like, you can contact me at All About Jazz. You can download the podcast from www.jazzbastard.com, from iTunes, or if you prefer, there is a monthly summary of our episodes posted on All About Jazz towards the end of the month, the beginning of the next month, but right around there you can find it. Tune in next time as we start year 6 with an episode devoted to two albums by Gregory Porter, the latest Kamasi Washington release, and Matt Wilson's project on the poetry of Carl Sandburg. Till next time, take care.
I just rewatched Terminator 3, where the computers become sentient and Skynet takes over everything. And based on this experience, I'm pretty fucking sure that Microsoft is Skynet. Basically, they want access to all of your passwords through this fucking system.
Yeah, it's a mess.
My password is fuck Microsoft.
They're probably used to seeing that a lot.